Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And the first item I'm bringing you today is called Tasty Idioms. The idiom in apple pie order certainly wasn't inspired by pies like the author of this article. The ones that she made have uneven edges, are filled with roughly sliced apples, and barely have a pastry cover. Now, on the other hand, the British would call these tarts. By contrast, their pies are completely encased in pastry. Well, was this expression, which first appeared in 1780, based on pies made to a more exacting standard? English is full of odd food idioms. Why does bring home the bacon mean earn the money that is needed to live? And what is so bad about sowing wild oats? The most common etymology of our first idiom holds that bakers created pies that were so beautifully arranged, the apples evenly sliced, the crust neatly edged, that their desserts became a byword for perfect order. Victorian etymologists scorned such a homely origin, though, and they posited instead that apple pie was a corruption of ca-a-pi, Old French for from head to foot, and used in English to describe the perfectly appointed armor and the weapons of a knight. The most likely explanation, though, is domestic but not pie-related. It comes from the French nappe-plié, as neat as folded linen. Well, no one knows how bacon became associated with money, but etymologists have had lots of fun speculating. County fairs, one-story posits, featured races in which people chased after a greased pig. Whoever caught the slippery animal won a prize and was said to bring home the bacon. Another version, though, attributes it to a custom once practiced in England. A flitch of bacon, which was an unsliced side, was awarded to couples who could swear that in their first year of marriage, they had never repented of their choice of spouse. Etymologists now take the view that the idiom is a 20th century invention. It appeared in a 1906 telegram from the mother of boxer Joe Gans, who urged her son to win a fight and bring home the bacon. Sports writers love this turn of phrase, and it was soon in newspapers across the country. Wild oats, though, are a different species from the ones we eat, as you would discover if you research the origins of to sow one's wild oats. The Oxford English Dictionary defines the phrase as to commit youthful excesses or follies, which sounds quaint rather than reprehensible. When the idiom was first used in the 17th century, however, people were more familiar with wild oats. They are pernicious weeds that have no value as a crop, and that once they're sown, are nearly impossible to eradicate. They keep coming up. So sowing one's wild oats was originally a much more serious issue, implying that a young man was not only not doing anything productive, but he was also setting himself up for a pattern of dissolution that would be very hard to break. And from that, a tasty idiom, we go to something that is really tasty, and that is peanut butter. North Americans weren't the first to grind peanuts. The Incas beat us to it by a few thousand years. But peanut butter reappeared in the modern world because of an American. The doctor, nutritionist, and cereal pioneer, John Harvey Kellogg, who filed a patent for a proto-peanut butter in 1895. Kellogg's food compound involved boiling nuts and grinding them into an easily digestible paste for patients at the Battle Creek Sanitarium, a spa for all kinds of ailments. The original patent didn't specify what type of nuts to use, and Kellogg experimented with almonds as well as peanuts, which had the virtue of being cheaper. While modern peanut butter enthusiasts would likely find Kellogg's compound very bland, Kellogg called it the most delicious nut butter you ever tasted in your life. Well, he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he endorsed a plant-based diet and promoted peanut butter as a healthy alternative to meat, which he saw as a digestive irritant and worse, a sinful sexual stimulant. His efforts and his elite clientele, which included Amelia Earhart and Henry Ford, helped establish peanut butter as a delicacy. As early as 1896, the Good Housekeeping magazine encouraged women to make their own peanut butter with a meat grinder and suggested pairing the spread with bread. The active brains of American inventors have found new economic uses for the peanut, said the Chicago Tribune in July 1897. Before the end of the century, Joseph Lambert, an employee at Kellogg Sanitarium, who may have been the first person to make the doctor's peanut butter, had invented machinery to roast and to grind peanuts on a larger scale. He launched the Lambert Food Company, selling nut butter and the mills to make it, seeding countless other peanut butter businesses. As manufacturing scaled up, prices came down. A 1908 ad for the Delaware-based Loeber's peanut butter, since now discontinued, claimed that just 10 cents worth of peanuts contained six times the energy of a porterhouse steak. Technological innovations would continue to transform the product into a staple, something Yanks couldn't do without, and many a foreigner considered appalling. Well, by World War I, U.S. consumers, whether convinced by Kellogg's nutty nutrition advice or not, turned to peanuts as a result of meat rationing. Government pamphlets promoted meatless Mondays with peanuts high on the menu. Americans soon may be eating peanut bread spread with peanut butter and using peanut oil for our salad, according to the newspaper The Daily Missourian in 1917, citing the exigencies of war. The nation's food scientists are nothing if not ingenious, however, And peanut butter posed a slippery problem that cried out for a solution. Manufacturers sold tubs of peanut butter to local grocers and advised them to stir frequently with a wooden paddle. According to Andrew Smith, a food historian, well, in a slight pause, I can remember that as a small boy, it's still in primary school, going to the IGA market in the small town where my father was born. And there, the market had barrels of pickles and peanut butter, and you stirred the peanut butter and you got your own pickles. It was a lot of fun, more fun than shopping today, I think. Well, the manufacturers that sold these tubs made money, and the local grocers made money. And so peanut butter became more popular. Without regular effort, though, at the time, the oil would separate out and spoil, and the peanut butter would not be usable. But then in 1921, a Californian named Joseph Rosefield filed a patent for applying a chemical process called partial hydrogenation to peanut butter. This was a method by which the main naturally occurring oil is in peanut butter, which is liquid at room temperature, is converted into an oil that's solid or semi-solid at room temperature, and thus remains blended. The practice had been used to make substitutes for butter and lard, like Crisco. But Rosefield was the first to apply it to peanut butter. The more stable spread could be shipped across the country. It could be stocked in warehouses and left on shelves, clearing the way for the national brands that we all know today. The only invention that did more than hydrogenation to cement peanut butter in the hearts and mouths of America's youth was sliced bread. Introduced by a St. Louis baker in the late 1920s, sliced bread made it easy for kids to construct their own PB&Js. In this century, the average American kid eats some 1,500 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches before graduating from high school. And now, for a short break, enjoy the music. And now, a new index revises expectations. What I'm talking about is the expected family contribution, that dreaded and confusing term for parents about to send their children to college. This made little sense in the best of times, and now it's finally going away. Among the orders and the edicts that were spilling into the 5,000 plus pages of the bill in Congress, signed into law in early January, was one that strikes the three words from Federal Higher Education Act and replaces them with Student Aid Index. As many as 19 million students and their families encounter the EFC each year. It's the dollar figure they see after they've answered scores of questions on the free application for federal student aid form. It's called FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, which must be filled out annually to qualify and then re-qualify for federal loans, grants, and even certain jobs. Well, good riddance too. For decades now, families have been baffled by the EFC, the output of a federal formula that uses income and some household assets. Given that it doesn't account for parents' own student debt, for example, plenty of people wondered whether the extra large number was what they were supposed to pay for 4 years of college and not just one. Well, it wasn't. Then there are the words themselves, the great expectations that felt more like a demand, the unspoken assumption that, of course, families would step up and pay. Parents, really, in the case of most students, hoping to matriculate straight from high school, and the notion that this was a mere contribution bathed in niceties, when in reality, the bill could spiral well into six figures. Well, goodbye to all that, to the judgment those words implied, to the things they meant but did not say, and to all of the euphemisms that have seeped into a system that has led to so much anxiety for so many families and the professionals who counsel them. The underlying formula that determines the new index will change some. Many more people will get federal Pell Grants for lower income students, or qualify for the maximum amount. Other tweaks may mean even more disappointment for higher income parents when the new index produces an even larger dollar figure than the EFC did. But for now, let's celebrate the banishment. As of the 2022-2023 application season, of each of these hateful words from our lives, one by one, and the emotional toll that they took on countless parents. Some more mysterious signals from space. Astronomers hunting for signs of alien life have detected a beam of radio waves coming from the direction of the star Proxima Centauri, and they don't know its source. It's some sort of technological signal, according to a researcher. The question is whether it's Earth technology or technology from somewhere out yonder. Proxima Centauri is the closest known star to the Sun, about 4.24 light years from Earth, and part of the three-star Alpha Centauri system. It has at least two planets, one of which is in the so-called habitable zone, where temperatures might allow for water on the surface. The narrowband radio signal was detected by an observatory in Australia in 2019, and it had a frequency of 982 megahertz. Natural cosmic phenomena, such as exploding stars, typically broadcast on a wide range of frequencies. False alarms are common in this field, and the signal is most likely human-made radio interference. But so far, investigators cannot fully explain it. Well, and now on to some news about health. Rather surprising. Benefits of brown fat. If you want to live longer, it might help to have more fat. Brown fat, that is. Unlike white fat, which stores energy in pockets around the body, brown fat helps burn calories and create heat. This so-called good fat is common in newborns. But in 2009, scientists discovered that some adults have it too. In a new study, scientists analyzed the PET scans of about 52,000 cancer patients, and they found signs of brown fat in nearly 10% of the group, and discovered that those individuals were less likely to suffer from type 2 diabetes, abnormal cholesterol levels, hypertension, congestive heart failure, and coronary artery disease. That was true even if the patient was obese. It's not clear why brown fat appears to have this effect. It might help lower blood glucose levels and could possibly participate in hormonal signaling to organs. There is some evidence that brown fat can be generated through exercise, good sleep, and frequent exposure to the cold. But scientists say that much more research is needed about this. Well, I would think so. And now, going back to outer space. When the headlines get you down, try taking the long view, an astronomically long view. That, according to an article in theatlantic.com. For 30 years, the Hubble Space Telescope has been capturing dazzling images of distant galaxies, star clusters, and nebulae. And they're all free to peruse at nasa.gov. You don't have to be an astronomer in order to appreciate them. They are, to begin with, simply pretty. And they can serve as momentary distractions, small bursts of wonder, and they might even be good for the mind. When you gaze across the expanse of space, feelings of awe usually kick in. And they often lead to a sense of insignificance. That may sound like a feeling you want to avoid, but as research shows, a shot of awe can boost feelings of connectedness with other people. We're going to be ending the show today with a little bit of wit and wisdom. These are quotations from famous people, such as Edgar Allan Poe, who said, "I have great faith in fools. Self-confidence, my friends, will call it." And Dolly Parton, quoted in the New Sentinel, said, "Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity." And the author André Gide is quoted as saying, "Believe those who are seeking the truth, doubt those who find it." And the writer Hugh Kingsmill is quoted in Forbes.com. He said, "Friends are God's apology for relations." And Robert Frost was quoted as saying, "The best way out is always through." That in goodreads.com. And we end our wit and wisdom with some few words from Fran Lebowitz, the humorist, is quoted in the New Yorker magazine. "There are only two kinds of people in the world. The kind of people who think there's such a thing as enough money, and the kind of people who have money." Think about that. Well, my friends, it's time to close down for today. This is Dan Dillman asking you to stay safe. Wear your mask. Be sure you keep that social distance, because that helps all of us. Have a good day, my friends. And tune in to a little of this, a little of that. I like having you around and knowing that you appreciate these little segments that I offer to you. So when you tune in, 101.5, I'll be there waiting for you. And now it's good day.